get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have another SEO Fight Club member, Lee Witcher. Now, Lee is a hardcore SEO tester. He loves the data, basically spends his time testing and trying to essentially push the Google algorithm or push the Google rules as far as he can to figure out what's actually true. And we dive into a few different things within this regarding typical maybe SEO myths and things that he's tested and found that do work that maybe Google says not to do. We don't just cover that, but we also cover some of his conversion rate optimization background as well, and dive into a few things with optimizing sales pages, unique things you can do with optimizing button colors or images within that, and things that can be applied to your affiliate stuff. The thing that I really enjoyed now during this was images, being able to optimize images through alt text as well. So there's plenty in here you can use to help optimize some of your pages for SEO, and plenty of things to rethink as well as maybe someone building websites or doing SEO. So sit back and enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show, and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
All right. Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have a third member from the SEO Fight Club Podcast, Lee Witcher. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, thanks for coming on and joining us. And I guess for people who aren't familiar with who you are, because I think, as we talked before the podcast, I think you've only done one other podcast before, so you might not have the biggest social footprint. So maybe you want to just dive into a little bit about yourself.
Well, my background, I've been working in sort of database marketing, direct marketing for 30 years. I have my background is really on the analytics testing side of things. I tell people I've tinkered around in SEO for over a decade, but really only done it seriously since 2018. At that point, I've done like a lot of people do. You know, you go through and you listen to different people, you buy different courses, you buy different software. None of it ever works out the way you hope. It's no different than, you know, what you guys do with the niche website stuff. You buy a blogging course and, you know, you put up a few blog posts and think, well, now I'm on my way. And you know, it had never occurred to me to apply my analytical skills to SEO. So I started testing things out there, and I was looking at who else was testing things out there, who else was analyzing things out there. And I wanted to see if what they were doing would hold up if I did it in a very rigorous manner. And I found out who was reliable, who wasn't reliable, and started just replicating that and expanding on it. And then it was August of 2018 when Google sort of unleashed the AI that changed SEO. And so from that point, it became a very serious try to figure out how to deal with the volatility, how to deal with the changes that Google was making constantly. Instead of having, you know, updates once or twice a year, it was now every couple of weeks type of, you know, mini updates and that sort of thing. So I kind of did a lot of stuff behind the scenes, met up with a few people, like Ted Kubitis was one of them. And then when they started SEO Fight Club, they were like, you need to come out and show people a little bit about what you're doing because it's kind of cool. I was like, I kind of like to work a little bit behind the scenes. So I still have a little bit of a small footprint there, although I am out there a little bit more than I used to be.
Yeah, for sure. I see. I think it's up to the right of you there. Almost looks like you have a whole lot of analytical math equations there. Is that geared towards your, on the wall there, is that geared towards your SEO testing?
It is a little bit, you know, the stuff, you know, even if you go back to direct marketing and database marketing, you know, simple A/B testing of stuff, you know, if you're selling apparel, for example, this shirt, you know, or a blouse for a woman, you know, is it better to show one blouse or one blouse on a model or five blouses out on a table? Is it better to sell it for $24, $29, $34, you know, whatever it is, all of those things are testable. And so I was the guy just sitting back and analyzing stuff and trying to figure out how to extract your credit card information from you, you know, just showing you different things and what was the optimal way of doing that. Same set of skills that you use in SEO to sort of reverse engineer Google's algorithm. So it's a lot of geeky stuff, but it's fun. I enjoy it.
Do you have any tests off the top of your head there that might be, I guess, beneficial for the listeners in terms of things that you have found that work well in SEO?
Yeah, there's a lot. You know, I have a training that I do that's sort of an advanced SEO training that I do where I, you know, go into the stuff that I don't talk about publicly. But publicly, there's some things out there that I've done. And it starts with just, you know, simple curiosity. Like right now, one of the hot topics out in the space is helpful content, Google's helpful content update, and how's it going to impact everything and so forth. And one of the things that people don't realize is that Google can't actually read. You know, they look at it and say, all right, well, I use, you know, neural linguistic, you know, NLP, and I look at all these sort of things, you know, I use, you know, these tools that tell me exactly how to optimize. And they're correct to a degree, but people think it's almost like your grade school English teacher is there with a red pen and Google's evaluating your content in that way. But we find that, you know, people have proven that lorem ipsum content can rank if done the right way. People find that just straight gibberish content can rank if done the right way. So, you know, when we're looking at something like the helpful content update, until we see Google adjust from that model, we know they're not reading the way that you and I read. And, you know, we keep testing on, you know, things like that. Other things, one of my favorite sacred cows is the one that is controversial all over the place, is keyword density. People tell you, oh, don't use your keyword too many times, or, you know, bad things happen. And while that is true, the point at which bad things happen is a lot further out than what people think. So if you use a tool like Quora to analyze any competitive SERP, you'll find that most of the people that are ranking on page one use their keyword on their page a lot more than everybody else does, and a lot more than what the guidelines would say. So most people are afraid to sort of push that stuff, and I spend my life trying to push the thing to find out exactly the point at which, you know, it becomes a problem. And so, you know, it's those kind of things right now that are topical, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I guess regarding that keyword density, then, does that mean you obviously mentioned that people generally shouldn't worry about using the keyword too many times, but is there a point where you're using the keyword so many times that maybe you're neglecting some of the related terms or missing just some points in your article because of that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I have to distinguish, but that's a great point. You have to distinguish between two different things. One is content for SEO. That's a machine that's coming and extracting information from your page, analyzing it, and making some determinations. The human being that comes to your page, you know, if you just stuff your keyword all there, it's not going to convert. They're going to bounce. They're going to leave. So there's a difference between SEO and CRO in terms of the content visible on the page. So while we've tested, you know, keyword densities up to 95% do not incur a penalty, but they don't convert. You know, if somebody comes to your page and they see socks, 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 you know, something, they're not going to buy socks from you. So, and yes, you can neglect other things. It's not just about that, but that tends to be the one that has stayed around forever is people are afraid to actually utilize those keywords. You know, that you hear things, you know, I've put it on the page like 4 times. Dare I put it on a 5th time? My wife just ran a test on this sort of thing, and she put the exact match on the page 4,000 times, and it bounced her out of the SERP. Now she's dropping it down to 2,000, 1,500, what, you know, and she'll come down, and one day she'll jump up out of her desk and go, 650, that's the limit. You know, we'll find where those limits are, but generally when we find them, they're way further out than what people think they are. So, you know, that's kind of a, I find people being afraid of incurring the penalty. And a lot of times, even if you do use your keyword too much and incur a bad outcome, you can always remove a few. And in a few days, you're right back where you were. So those are very, very fixable errors. You know, you don't go into the doghouse forever.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned as well with the helpful content update, how Google doesn't read your content like a teacher with a red pen. So does that mean, I guess, from a person who's building a website, what is then helpful content to the user? So how can I write helpful content? And do I even need to worry about that update? Is anything happening with it?
I think the way that I think about it, we don't know. Let's just be clear, because it's new, it's out there. We don't know exactly when it's going. We know that Google started to roll it out, but we don't know by their own documentation. They said, we're going to evaluate your website over a period of time, let's say 6 months, and then we're going to make some determinations. Well, we don't know if they started 6 months ago and they're now making determinations, or whether they're starting today and it'll be 6 months before we start to see anything, and what those determinations are and how you'll know whether or not it's helpful content or not. But the intriguing thing about this is the first time that Google's really gone on record saying there are domain level factors. There's always been this principle that Google ranks pages, not websites. Now, a website can have an influence over that, but they're not ranking your website, they're ranking pages. And so if they're thinking about website domain level stuff, how do you determine a good domain from a bad domain? A good website from a bad, what are some of the signals that you could use that would be easy for Google to do that? Well, one of the simplest ones is traffic. You know, if you have 1,000 pages on your website, you get 100 visitors a month, your website's not very good. You know, at least it's not attracting the other kind of thing. And maybe they could make some determinations about whether or not they want to index your content going forward. You know, those sort of things are there. So we're not at a point yet where I'm seeing anything that I can peg and say, yeah, that's helpful content in action. And this seems to be the way Google's going. And we'll test that. You know, if we see some behaviors, you know, we'll test to figure out exactly where the rules are. But today, no, I wouldn't. Just continue to do what you're doing if it's working, and, you know, make sure that you're doing stuff that you can attract some visitors to. And if it's converting well for you, great. I don't think you have anything to worry about there.
Nice. I want to actually dive into a little bit of that CRO stuff, because it sounds like you've done a bit of testing there. But before I get there, if someone's listening to this and they want to potentially start testing whatever it is in SEO themselves, how would they go about starting that?
You know, it's interesting. I used to teach, you know, sort of how to test in SEO and stuff like that. And I was actually thinking about putting out a little course out there, because we need more people doing that. But you don't have to have the biggest thing that people worry about is you have to have like a PhD in statistics to understand blah, blah. No. Most of the time when we're testing stuff, I'll set up 10 pages that are, you know, and on, let's say, 5 of them, I'll do one thing, and the other 5, I'll do another. And, you know, if the other thing is a ranking factor, the second 5 pages should rank above the first 5 pages. It's real simple, you know, to do that. You can see.
Would this be on different, each page on different domain, would it?
Yeah. And I buy, like when I'm buying setting up testing domains, I buy usually .xyz domains because they're a dollar. Well, now they're $2, so my testing cost is doubled. But, you know, and I'll use those for a year and just put up, you know, a page across, you know, all 10 and then, you know, get them, you know, crawled and then just see what happens in the SERPs. And that's sort of the strict, call it the laboratory testing. But you can also test in the real world. If you had your blog and you decided, you know what, I want to see if a longer title does anything, take half a dozen of your blog posts and expand the title out a little bit, get them crawled and see what happens. Do you get more impressions? Does your, you know, rank move up or down or something along those lines? You know, compare those pages to the ones that you did nothing with and try to sort of pair them up. And then you can get, when you do that multitude of times, you can get a feeling for, yeah, that seems to move the needle, or, you know, that did nothing, or it did something bad. And, you know, if it did something bad, just revert it back, say, don't do that again.
Yeah. Have you ever tested redirecting a domain that, say, got hit by an update to a fresh domain? So, for example, you have maybe a blog, you have 20 posts on it, you get hit by an update, you lose a bunch of your traffic and keywords, and you redirect that domain and all the blog posts and pages to a new domain.
Haven't tested that. I know some people that, you know, they've done some of those things and had mixed results, but nobody's done it like systematically. I'm going to try to recover these five this way, and these five I'm going to do this other technique with. So, you know, if something is hit by a penalty, I have a friend right now who just bought a website. And it's had two previous owners, and the website had one of these trajectories where it went, you know, up like this, and then an owner took over and it went down to here, and then a new owner took over and it went down to here. And so then my friend bought it. And he's like, all right, let's go and see what's going on to recover this. A lot of times the things are technical, you know, people implemented things, they customized things without knowing, or they said, oh, I don't like all these backlinks, so they disavowed them, and, you know, then their rankings tanked because they no longer have any decent links, you know. It's those sort of things that you see, you know, people move around. And they're easier to fix if you understand those. So before I would ever look at redirecting a problematic domain, I would sit there and say, what's wrong with, you know, with it? You know, what is it that could possibly explain why it tanked? And sometimes you find it's simple things like, you know, you lost a bunch of your backlinks. You know, there's things like that that happen. You're like, okay, well, if I build backlinks back up, I'll return back to my previous, you know, rankings and traffic levels. So I like to go with the simple solutions before I, you know, resort to the bigger problematic solutions.
Nice. I want to jump into a little bit of the CRO stuff, because
sure,
I personally enjoy and like this because I sell digital products as well. So it's nice to be able to try eke out a little bit more percentage just from having the same thing there. So I don't know how much, I guess you've done, I think you mentioned in your introduction that you've done a bit of e-com in terms of that. So it kind of translates well over. So do you want to maybe dive into maybe the big rocks that kind of move the needle in terms of, I guess, on page? So things, people often talk about like button color. You obviously mentioned pricing there as well. Maybe anything else in that regard?
You know, one of the interesting things is that I've found most of the things that I have found that move the needle are the things that are more emotionally evocative. I'll give you an example of that that comes from work that I did in the travel industry. Okay. If you're selling a trip to Australia, you know, it's very common to see, you know, the Sydney Opera House or some kangaroos or, you know, something along those lines that, you know, there you go. But one of the things that we tested with a client on one of their prospecting pieces was those sort of classic images versus images that were a less boring, I guess would be the easiest way of saying it. So we had a picture. One of the interesting pictures that we had was we had an Aboriginal teenager. He had, you know, dusty, you know, he had, you know, crooked teeth and stuff like that. And he had his hands out like this to you. And it was filled with grubs. You know, it was like showing you some of the, you know, the foods that they'd gathered up and stuff like that. And it gives you an emotional reaction. It may not even be, you know, joy or something happy. You're just looking at that. But what it does is it's real. It put you, oh, this is Australia. You know, it's not the tourist places and things like that. And that thing performed three times as well as their previous, you know, prospecting piece, which was more traditional. So I find when you break the frame more, which is where people are afraid to go, you can find bigger home runs, you know, with your stuff. So, you know, that's what, you know, the button color and some of those things, yes, there are some principles that go along with that. Yeah, you can pick those up and, you know, get a percent gain here and a percent gain there. But if you really want to do something that moves the needle, you've got to test some crazy stuff or what is perceived as crazy stuff.
The image thing is actually quite, the image thing's interesting for me because I'm just kind of thinking of my own landing pages as well. So I'm in kind of health and fitness area. So if I was going to take that example, say I was selling some kind of workout program or whatever, you would have almost like an image of someone lying on the floor exhausted. And that would be kind of like an emotive, I guess. Image.
Yeah, it would be, but you know, if they sit there and they have sort of this happy, relieved, and you know, you can see that they've done some work and they've got a little bit, it doesn't have to be, you know, a fitness model or an obvious body. It could be somebody that looks like me, but if there's a little definition and stuff like that, and it's kind of a, you know, a feeling okay. of damn, I made it through this thing, then people can relate to that more than, you know, the guy that's, you know, 6'4", 280 and has got 2% body fat. You know, people can't relate to that as well. I mean, they aspire to that, but then they're looking at it and going, how many years is it going to take me to do that? I don't have, you know, all the years to go to the gym.
Or I don't want to look like that. I just want to, you know,
yes,
be a little whatever.
Yeah, so I mean, those kind of things are, you know, the things that I find move the needle the most on the CRO side of things is just the crazy stuff. You know, even in years, I mean, this is like 15 years ago, pop-ups were the big thing. Everybody was trying to use pop-ups and everybody got tired of pop-ups and, you know, everything else. And I had a client that was, you know, we said, let's just test on your pop-up a little bit. And one of the things that we did, they were offering, you know, $100 off your first order. You know, all you had to do is give us an email so you can sign up, you know, be on our mailing list and, you know, get whatever the hell, you know, they were sending out. Most people clicked off, you know, I don't want to just click, you know, close. No, thanks. I'll miss out on this sort of stuff. I changed the no thank you, I'll miss out on this, to no thanks, I don't need the money. You know how hard it is to sit there and say, hey, would you like $100 off? No thanks, I don't need the money. Nobody likes to click on that. So the signups tripled again. You know, it was like those sort of things. They went from, I don't know, like 6% sign up to 18, you know, something percent sign up just for that one change. And of course, we did some other design changes and it moved it up further than that. But it's just things like that, that you're trying to provoke a reaction. People are trying to provoke a happy reaction. I'm trying to provoke a reaction. And those sort of things move the needle. Even if they're negative, they can be positive in the impact on your page.
I'm taking mental notes on this because I need to start implementing some of the stuff that, yeah, that's, I think my, what did mine say? I think mine just says, no thanks, I'm not interested or something like that. So
yeah,
I think I need to change mine for sure.
You've made it easy to bore me now. You know, it's like, you know, don't do that. Don't do the things that they're expecting. You have to, you know, break them up. And that's also one of the other principles. This goes back to all the direct response copywriters and things like that. When you're doing ads, direct response stuff that works is ugly. It really does. It has, you know, the bursts and the banners across things and things that are just, you know, they move your eye around, but they're unsettling. You know, you have things like the gap ads where they're just very simple. You've got a model standing there, you know, like this, you know, the gap. And it's like, that's what we like. You know, those win awards, but they don't move people to buy. You know, you have to provoke a reaction to get somebody to want to click and give you their credit card. So you have to do something to get them out of that. And it's not going to be by looking like everybody else. So
nice. But before I go into some of that copy stuff, you talked about pricing at the very beginning. Now, obviously, I think, I don't know if it's, if there's some kind of psychology behind it, or someone just made it popular with everything ending in seven. So it's $7, mm-hmm. $17, $97, whatever. Is there something behind that? Is that something that have you tested that?
That, you know, we've tested a little bit, you know, with those sort of clients, because, you know, I do more, a lot more CRO historically, SEO now. But, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of stuff, it still works. You know, even if I'm going to price something right now, if it's going to be, you know, $10,000, it's going to be $9,997. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's there because, again, that seven breaks the standard. Everybody expects a five, a nine, or a zero.
Okay.
So, you know, and seven works, I mean, it would work, you know, 9,993 would work, but seven seems to, you know, trigger something in people. I don't know what it is, but it works. So there you go.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep using it then.
I mean, here's the other thing, that this goes back to the SEO portion of it. SEO and CRO don't have to be divorced from each other, because Google evaluates the entirety of your HTML. So you've got what's visible on the page and you've got what's under the page. And you can do a lot of SEO under the page that's not visible. So you get this, you know, the page that you want for the user experience, and I get the page that I want for, you know, Google's algorithms. Those two things can be married together. People don't think of SEO in those terms. So yeah, there's a lot that can be done that way.
So when we're talking under the page, what are we referring to in particular?
Here's an example. People know that you should optimize your images, you know, use alt text. That alt text doesn't appear on the page, but it is included as part of what Google determines your page is about. In the algorithms, they'll look at that alt text. Nothing says your alt text has to be five words. You know, you can put several hundred words in alt text. You know, and it works. You can do with schema. A lot of people like to use, you know, very advanced sort of schemas. There are a lot of fields in schema that are text fields. You could put a 10,000 word article in schema. It would be under the page in the HTML, not visible, and doing SEO work for you. So, I mean, these are sort of, you know, different things. You have to think about what is it that the algorithm is extracting from the page and where. Not everything that they're extracting is visible. So you can use that to your advantage if you want to have a look and feel and the SEO result. They're not mutually exclusive.
Gotcha. What are your best practices for image alt text?
You know, you understand sort of the keywords and entities and things like that. So you want to be descriptive around that. So I wouldn't have, if I had a picture of like the Eiffel Tower in Paris, I wouldn't have, you know, my Paris vacation or, you know, something like that. I might have, you know, my vacation to Paris, France had, you know, it included visits to the Eiffel Tower and this, you know, and these other sort of, you know, destinations or landmarks there. So it becomes a very Paris-centric, you know, alt text, which helps, you know, Google understand that my page is about something related to Paris, France.
Okay. Yeah, at some point, I know I need to go back and edit all my alt text, because I think mine are just literally a lot of related keywords I just chucked in there because I was lazy.
And that's okay. You can do that too. I mean, because, you know, the algorithm, again, is not evaluating, you know, do you have subject-verb agreement in your alt text? You know, it's not doing that. It's just looking at it and saying, hey, here's more content that we're extracting from the page that we can use to determine what the page is about. So, you know, a machine looks at your page very differently. And that's one of the biggest things that people don't get. I mean, Google has a lot of really great patents and a lot of really great capabilities. But one of the things that people don't realize is that just because Google has the ability to read and understand a page, processing trillions of pages that way gets prohibitively expensive. So a lot of times a capability is possible, but it's not something that is feasible to do at scale at this time. So yeah, you know, you can, while they have patents to say, oh, we can do this and this, they're in practice, they're not actually doing those things.
Gotcha. So have you tested them between different search engines at all? In terms of what ranks? All right. Do you want to maybe dive into a little bit of I guess, what you found there.
I love Bing. I absolutely love Bing for a couple of reasons. Bing is, in their webmaster tools, they tell you what the algorithm is, and they're not lying. They're a very, very keyword-driven, exact match-driven search engine. And if you've got links from other properties that Bing knows about, that seems to be good enough. And a lot of the stuff that you do to optimize on Google also works on Bing. It just, you know, it's not as advanced on Bing. They're kind of like, you know, the dumb cousin in terms of that. So they're very manipulatable in that way. But, you know, it's a great source of additional traffic and revenue that most people, you know, overlook. So if you're a blogger, you know, I would make sure that I just added it to Bing Webmaster Tools, because for a lot of terms here, you can pick up 10 to 30% additional traffic just by doing that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've added my sites to Bing Webmaster Tools, but I haven't seen the response. I guess that same response of 10 to 30% traffic, I get hardly any impressions and maybe a few clicks. But on Google, it's doing really well. So to me, I'm just not sure.
It's interesting because here's the other thing that is a fun little thing about Bing. One, they're kind of a Nazi in terms of there's certain things that your site has to have, and they're very, very strict about it. So if you have like an XML sitemap, great. If you have an XML sitemap and it has more than, I think it's 1.something% errors, so if you screw up on something in that sitemap, Bing says, hey, if you don't care about your site, we're not going to index you. I mean, they're really, really strict. But if you follow the rules, you know, you can get that. Bing is also made up of a different demographic than Google is. Everybody thinks that Bing is made up of old people who don't know how to change their default search engine. And while there is some of that, there's also people who are very, very sophisticated, very high income, and don't like Google tracking everything that they do. So that's why they go to Bing or DuckDuckGo or, you know, some of these alternate, you know, search engines. So they tend to be a little older than the average. They have higher incomes and stuff like that. And so when you do get traffic, it converts better. But depending on what you're blogging on, that demographic may not, you know, do it. So if you're trying to get cutesy little teen TikTok stuff, you know, on Bing, you're not going to get any traffic because that's not where, you know, that's not where that group is. But if you're doing something like personal injury law, you know, that's a group that will search for it, and you can get some really, really nice. So it's keyword dependent there.
Gotcha. So have you tested, I guess, is DuckDuckGo much different? And then obviously Ahrefs' new search engine, yep.com?
I haven't tested Ahrefs' stuff at all. DuckDuckGo and Yahoo both get their feeds from Bing. The only difference between them is, you know, every search engine does a little bit of personalized search. DuckDuckGo's claim to fame is that they don't, you know, they don't track your history and stuff like that. Yahoo does. So that Bing and Yahoo can be a little bit different depending on what you've done on each one. If you haven't done a lot on either, they're going to be basically identical. So the three search engines underlying them are all Bing fed. So you've got, you know, Bing 1, Bing 2, and Bing 3.
gotcha.
The Ahrefs one is interesting. I won't do anything with that until they start to get, you know, some significant traction. You know, it's not worth going after 0.000, you know, something along those lines. There's many other things that need to be tested and optimized before you go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, for sure. Coming back a little bit to the CRO side, I wanted to ask you more about this emotive, I guess, bringing out some kind of emotion from the user. Obviously, this can also be applicable to people who have maybe affiliate pages who are trying to sell best, you know, vacuum cleaner, whatever.
Right.
I guess, this is a very general question then. Do you have any kind of advice for the copy to be able to bring out that kind of emotion from someone? Because sometimes it can't always be done with pictures, maybe in that instance.
Well, yeah, it can. But if I sit there and tell you that this, you know, this vacuum cleaner, you know, cleans up better and it filters out better and it'll pull more, you know, stuff out of your rug than, you know, brands X, Y, and Z or whatever else, you're like, okay, that's fairly traditional. But if I sit there and say, you know what, this stuff is powerful enough to just, you know, suck everything in a, you know, 24-inch radius. So when you stick this under the front of your couch in the back, the goopy, nasty dust bunny covered with, you know, your kid's peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but, you know, that, and it'll pull it right out. You're looking and going, oh, God, yeah, you know, that's a nasty image. But the fact that that can go back there and get it now, like, okay, I want this thing, because that's a real feeling that you're having about that. I said, oh, you know, it cleans up every year and it's, you know, HEPA filter, you know, all these sort of things. You're like, okay, nice, nice. Now everybody says that. So you can't say it like everybody else. You've got to find some way of triggering an emotion.
I can imagine that levels up the reviews massively as well. Because obviously, as you mentioned, everything on the first page of Google is just kind of bland, you know, a rehash of the description, and that's pretty much all you get.
Exactly. So they're fairly easy. You know, most of those things from a CRO perspective, I've often found are, you know, fairly easy to beat, because you just go and, you know, you change it up. You change it up in a way that's noticeable. You know, if I ask, you know, if you have you're on a health website and, you know, you're coming onto a page or something like that, or you're sending out an email and the subject line, you know, would be, oh, you know, bulk up here, you know, what is something along those lines. If I asked a question in the subject line, you know, how is your next workout like a vacuum cleaner? You know, now you have to open that up. You know, it's clickbaity, but it's very different. You know, it's not a pair that you would see. If I said, how's your next workout like, you know, climbing a mountain, you can visualize that, but you can't visualize how your next workout's like a vacuum cleaner. So now you got to go find out. You're going to move people because it's not what they're expecting.
Okay. Now you got me thinking more too.
Well, I mean, that's the thing on CRO, SEO, it's all the same stuff. You have to look at it a little bit differently and sort of see what are the mechanisms at play. In stuff that I train people on, ultimately what it comes down to is there are certain principles. There's 1,000 different ways of implementing it. But as long as the principles are adhered to, you can do it. So one of the questions I always get from people that are interested in that is like, do you like X backlink? You know, do you like guest posts? Do you like PBNs? Do you like, you know, Web 2.0? What is it? I'm like, I don't care. I honestly don't care. I can make all of them work as long as, you know, certain things are true. And when you understand those sort of principles, when you're looking at pages from an SEO or a CRO perspective, you're looking and saying, well, that's boring. That's news. I've seen that 1,000 times before. And your customers and prospects, when they're going down through that, they may not be analyzing it in that way, but they're feeling that way. You know, so they're just kind of, you see like the ad blindness and stuff like, because I've seen it before. I've seen it before. I've seen it before. You surround something on Facebook by really ugly color and people are going to stop scrolling to see what the hell that is. You know,
okay.
So you have to break people out of their normal pattern in order to get them to move in the direction you want them to move.
Interesting. Okay. This might not be relevant, but we mentioned button color before, and people will say a certain button color is the best for conversions. And obviously you're talking about breaking people out of patterns of whatever they're seeing. Is there a button color that works, or is it based on maybe your website's color scheme?
No, there are button colors that work because, you know, we have associations. Like if I tell you the color red, what do you associate that with?
Oh, I don't even know what I associate that with.
Most people stop, you know, or danger, those lines. Those are just, you know, associations that we have, you know, our heads from nature, all of those sort of things are kind of programmed that way. So, you know, there are certain things like that. I think the years ago, IBM did a color, and that IBM blue color, you know, based on all sorts of analytics and testing, was judged to be the most trustworthy, which is what they wanted to position themselves at. So you see a lot of professional service firms that'll use that tone of blue. And when you get there, subconsciously, you already begin to trust because of those things. So, you know, green buttons have a certain connotation. Red buttons have a certain connotation. But if I were going to go crazy with button testing, you know, what about a triangle button? You know, would that, you know, it might work the opposite way, but people might go, oh, wow, you know, and it might stop them. So things like that, you know, might be worth, you know, a test, not just the color. And your button text also is a great one for testing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Is there button text for, I guess, maybe first one for affiliate links, because people typically put check price, check current price to try to get someone to click on it. And then maybe one for e-commerce or someone selling their digital product to essentially click to go buy.
I'll just test them all. You know, there's not a one size fits all. And, you know, if everybody starts to, if I said buy now, if that were the thing and everybody starts to move to that, then buy now starts to get a blindness to it because everybody's seen the buy now button, you know. Then it's you got to move to something else to snap people out of their behavior pattern.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's just constant A/B testing.
It is. You know, you test until it starts to degrade, and then you know, you figure out something else. There's certain principles that are there, like you've got to stand out a little bit. But there's so many Me Too's out there that eventually you become the standard as opposed to the the newest the trendsetter. And sometimes you can go backwards. If everybody shifts over to one particular style, you might test something that used to work, 5 years ago and, bring it back because now it's less common and people respond to it again.
Nice. You mentioned as well about you didn't care what kind of backlink it was if you had these certain, principles or things in place. Now, I'm not sure if you can share those things in place, but then how would you use these different kind of backlinks? Obviously you mentioned guest posts, web 2.0s, anything else in between?
So I'll share a little bit of that. I'll just conceptually. Most people think that, it's better to have a relevant backlink, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say that's true. It is true, but let's say that that's true. Does it matter that that thing sits on a web 2.0 or a guest post or, a cloud property or, a PBN? No, it's a link and it's got certain, that article and that link, that anchor text, all of that sort of stuff sits somewhere and it's going to be evaluated based on where it sits and the things that point to that article. So do I care whether that happens on a particular property type? No, I don't. Does that make sense? Okay. As long as there. So you sit there and say, there's nothing magical about a cloud property or a PBN or Web 2.0 or anything else. There's generally, there's a few little minor things, but there's nothing magical about it. But people, when they find something that works, they're like, PBN links are the key, or back in the old SAPE links, or whatever it happens to be, and they fall in love with that, thinking that that's the mysticism, but it's not. And right now, one of the things that we're spending a lot of time thinking about is what does a backlink do? When you put you're basically linking one page to another, page A to page B. All right, so how much of it is the content? How much of it is the anchor text? And, whether it's the juice, the power, the whatever, does it just flow from B to A? Or does it, if I link out to other authority, is there some backflow? Is there some back benefit that I get from linking to a related authority site, for example? There are a lot of people that have theories about that, but nobody has a lot of tested data on that. Nobody really knows all the principles of a link. And there are some odd tests that we've had out there that the number of testers have reported. So if you have page B with an anchor text on it, and the anchor text, let's say, is a made-up term, so it only appears on page B anywhere on the web, and that points to page A, and you search for that keyword, that anchor text that's only in B, page A will show up for that search, which means that anchor text has transferred that word to its, destination page. So does that mean when I'm evaluating my page that part of my content is all the anchor text that's pointing to me? Does that make sense?
That makes sense. It's interesting you mentioned that. So I have one of my websites. So I had a link to a page of mine from a medical journal article. Someone cited my blog post. I don't know how they even got that published because that's not really scientific evidence to reference, but they reference it within there. I took that page. I redirected it out to another website of mine because it didn't make sense on my current site. But that, I don't know what happened. Somehow that link still linked to my homepage. And if you search this term, my homepage shows up on the second page of Google for this term, but I have no content about this thing on my site anymore. So I was like, that kind of just shows how powerful maybe some links are, because that was relevant on that topic, but I don't have anything anymore on that topic.
Right. You know, and it's those sort of things when you're thinking about it from an SEO perspective and you're evaluating it. It used to be we could just evaluate a page in somewhat of a vacuum, but now there's other things that come into play. So, you know, does your page stop at your URL or does it include the URLs that are pointing to you from other places? Is that now part of the content that's being evaluated to determine what your page is about and whether it's worthy of ranking? You know, the days of testing, you know, is whatever a ranking factor is, bold text, you know, a ranking factor is, you know, this a ranking factor. Those are fairly simple. Most of those are known and fairly well established. The question now is, how is Google combining all of this stuff into, you know, scores? You know, how what's the holistic way of the way they're evaluating a page? I have another friend of mine that we just were having a discussion 2 days ago, and we were designing some test structures to try to figure out, you know, Google has two bots that it crawls, well, it's got more than two, but it's got a mobile and a desktop bot that it crawls your content with. What does each one of them grab? You know, what is it that when they come to a page, what are they extracting from the page? You know, what is different about the mobile and desktop? Why do they need two of them? And how are they utilizing the information from each of them? So we've designed a methodology for feeding different bots different things and see what happens. You know, so we can try to determine this one gathers this information, that one gathers that information, and so then we know what's important to Google, you know, a little bit more.
Do you have any preliminary data that you could share from that?
I will share... my friend Carolyn Holzman has spent over a year watching Google bots in a number of different sites and cataloging that research on her website at American Way Media. So if you search for, she has a podcast out there and she has a, I'm trying to think, give me a second, I'll figure out what her daily is, but she has a Crawl or No Crawl, that's her YouTube piece, where every day she tells you what's going on with the Google bots and sort of what it means. And she's figured out there are patterns that detect an update. There are patterns that we found that detect that Google's having internal technical problems and things like that. And that is a great repository of research if you're interested in a little more technical, you know, what's going on with the bots and things like that. And she's certainly one of the people that's going to be involved in trying to figure out which bot does what and why.
Interesting. I guess the question becomes from that, how does that affect, I guess, the daily practice of someone building a website? Will this be able to tell us, I guess, what's most important to have on the page?
It can, you know, or, you know, here's an example. This came out of her research, which was kind of an interesting thing. One of the first things that when Googlebot crawls, looks for your homepage, and it looks for the robots.txt file, those are not surprises. But very frequently, it looks for your privacy policy. Like, why does it keep coming back to that page, you know, and so forth. So we started thinking, okay, well, if that's important, let's stick a privacy policy, you know, on some other sites. And those that got better indexation, you know, it's like, I don't say it's a trust signal, but it's like a checkbox, it seems, in Google. So if you have something, you don't have a privacy policy, contact us, stuff like that. And I have another friend that tested that, and they put up the privacy policy and contact us pages, and they were blank. So it's not the content on them. It's just the presence of them. It's almost like Google saying, okay, if you don't have these things, you know, there's, you get less credit than if you do have these things.
Okay.
And so if you've got a website right now and, you know, you don't have those things on there, you know, you might be at a disadvantage.
Okay. Okay. So that's like almost at the bare minimum you should have contact us privacy policy. I don't know, maybe affiliate disclosure, terms, conditions, all those kind of legal pages essentially.
Yeah, just, you know, are you a legitimate website? You know, those are just, you know, and again, the pages can be blank, so it's not like they're going and reading your privacy policy and determining whether it's a good one or a bad one. They're just looking for the presence of these particular things over and over and over again. And that came from, you know, following what they were grabbing in the logs, you know, on several sites for over a year, just noticing they keep checking for that. They keep checking for that. So why?
Interesting. Yeah, I guess that comes down to people also saying, you know, some other, I guess, trust signals is the idea of having some kind of address on your website or phone number, or so, even if you're an affiliate site. I don't know if that's important or not, but
we don't know. I mean, that's not something that we've tested, but you know, it certainly raises the question, you know, as to, you know, what's there, you know, what is it that Google keeps looking at and what does it keep coming back to? And, you know, are there signals that can be gleaned from that? Another thing that she found that's been in a lot of different groups, which was just a brilliant discovery, was if you're having trouble getting your content indexed, go through the Google API, the indexing API. And there's a number of ways of doing that. It seems as though until your site is up to a certain size and stature where Google is just crawling it repeatedly, they'll find your new content and index it. For smaller sites, especially if you're getting started, most people just have to go through Search Console. And that seems to be almost a negative indexation signal. It's almost like, you know,
So like if I just manually index through Google Search Console, that could be a negative to my site.
Yes, it could be a negative to that new content. That's some of the testing and things that have gone on. Whereas if you go through the indexing API, that's a whole different, you know, feed into Google. That seems to work well. There's a lot of things about Search Console that are broken right now, and that's one of the pieces that's been broken for quite a while. So newer sites, you know, newer content, if that's the first time, you know, Google hears about it, you're going to struggle, generally speaking, getting it indexed.
Okay. Because I've got a newer site that I've just kind of been building on the side as well, and I've been putting it through the manual Google Search Console, so now I'm going to stop just because of what you said.
Well, it's, you know, but here's the thing. If you revise something that's already indexed, if you get, you know, you can go to Search Console and get it recrawled fairly quickly. That is awesome. But for new content, it works backwards of what people think it does. And so they think things like, well, my site's got a penalty, or my content is not good enough, or, you know, whatever else that happens to be. And that's not the case. You know, it's just simply you've got a broken system, or a system you think works one way but doesn't. And that's a lot of what we find, you know, with Google, with SEO and, you know, everything else. There are certain things that they put out there and they say, and it either doesn't work that way, or we can prove that it doesn't work that way over and over again, or kind of partially works that way. It's a very complicated system to look at.
If someone was to look at going down the Google API route, how would they go about finding how to do it?
There's two primary ways that are that we utilize. If you have WordPress, the Rank Math Indexing API, it's Rank Math Indexing API. It's not the Rank Math SEO plugin. They've got a second one that does that. And you just go and follow their instructions. It seems technical, but it's fairly simple. You're going to go into to a Google developer thing and follow some steps to create an API connection and through Search Console and all that sort of stuff. Most people don't have any problems with it. It looks, you know, more terrifying than it actually is. If you have a site that doesn't have that capability, it's not WordPress, SEO Tools for Excel has their own interface with the indexing API. It's a different way of setting it up. They've got some nice instructions to follow on how to do that. And in that particular case, you just open up Excel, you put the URLs that you want indexed and, you know, in the indexing API and hit go, and then it just does it for you. It sends them.
I know, at least, I don't know, on which part of it is, but I know Google API, at least it says it should only be used for news sites, or I think it's something else. Should we be worried as affiliate normal blogs about that?
No.
No.
No, we've used them on hundreds. You know, I've got people that do SEO in just a bazillion different industries, and nobody has problems with it. You know, it is instant indexing, you know, or near instant indexing. You know, just depends on whether Google's got, you know, an update coming, and so then there's a little delays there, but it's your fastest way into the index.
Okay, perfect. But before we finish, I've got one last question for you, because sure. I know you've done a lot of testing, and I've asked a few people this, and they haven't been able to give me an answer, so I'm hoping you've done some testing on this, and that is Google Discover. And mm-hmm. I guess, so for myself, I get random Discover traffic, usually between updates. So if an update comes, my Google Discover comes back and skyrockets and stays up, and then a new update comes, and then it drops off and goes to zero again. It kind of just does that. And I wanted to know if you've done any testing of what, I guess, influences being able to get Google Discover traffic.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I'm going to disappoint you and say I don't know yet.
Okay.
But the good news is, you know, I have a couple of friends and I, we are building some niche information sites that we're going to monetize, you know, the traffic on, mm-hmm. the same way a lot of your followers do. And that's one of the things that we will be, you know, testing out on that to see, you know, exactly how that works and how we can influence it, because it is a decent source of traffic when it kicks in. So everybody's like, how do I kick it in and, you know, make it work, you know, a lot. So we're going to be trying to figure some of those things out.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously when you have your site initially, you don't have that Discover tab on Google Search Console. Then one day it just pops up and it's just there. Mm-hmm. Like you're eligible now to be on Google Discover. And then maybe one day you might get some traffic. But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's because the thing that was intriguing about it was, if you're going to try to build a site, so we're doing it from an SEO perspective. We can identify niches and things like that and say, you know what, we think we can rank. And that niche, you know, for the terms that we're looking at, has enough volume that the traffic would be worth some money. You know, it'd be a nice little income, just, you know, like you guys teach. But then you see things like, okay, Google Discover can amplify that. We always are interested in testing amplifiers, you know, to see if we can find a way, you know, to get Google to do this or Google Discover to do that in a way that, you know, boosts the return from anything that we do. So, yeah, we'll be testing it. You know, we'll be testing it probably in ways that we'll test stuff that's against terms of service too.
Nice.
You know, we have to go and see. You know, you have to find out where those limits are. So when we find them, you know, we can back off of them and say, you know what, you can push it out to here, but, you know, don't go there. That's crazy.
One thing I've found is the best roundup or affiliate style content doesn't ever make it into Google Discover. But I've had one, so usually it's just all my informational stuff, but I've had one article that was a review article that eventually got into Google Discover, a review of a product. And that's the only affiliate piece that's made it. And I don't know why that particular one just happened to, I guess, get picked up and Discover traffic and get, you know, 5,000 people clicking on it, whereas everything else before has only been informational content.
Yeah, it's intriguing. You know, that's you know, obviously if we were running affiliate, we'd love to have, you know, a review page get, you know, 10,000 visitors in a hurry, you know, for that. But you know, you don't know on those sort of things. But the fun part about it is, like, we'll go and test, I would say we test crazy shit so you don't have to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll give you a couple of examples of that before we go. Ted Kubaitis and I were having a conversation about how many keywords an individual page could rank for. You know, because you hear this concept of, you know, one page, one keyword, or, you know, one page, a tightly clustered theme, whatever. So we decided to test this by writing a 1 million word blog post.
Okay.
And it was entirely gibberish, you know, content, but it was all unique, so we could see how many terms you ranked for. And we found out it was about 180,000 of the terms that it ranked for. And it was the first 180,000. Like, there was a size limit You know, it seems like there's a size barrier in there that won't index your content, you know, below a certain size. Okay, that's cool. So we understand that. And the words that we were using, the content generator, you know, the words were almost like 12 characters on average, which is a lot longer than, you know, your standard English word. So later we had a few of us were having a conversation about the old title tag. And, you know, you have plugins like Yoast and some other SEO plugins that don't go beyond a certain character count because it'll trigger the ellipsis and you don't want that. And, you know, all of these things, even Bing will scream at you if you go beyond, you know, certain things. SEO plugins scream, don't go bad. You've done bad things. We didn't care about the plugins. We cared about what was the truth. So knowing that, I wrote a 200,000 word title tag, you know. So you hear people, oh, you shouldn't go beyond a certain thing. You shouldn't go beyond a certain thing. Well, you know what? All 200,000 words indexed. So there's not a practical limit. I mean, there's a technological limit, yeah, but there's not an SEO limit in that title tag. Now, it's ridiculous, but, you know, the idea that you can't go beyond, you know, 64 characters or so many pixels it's horribly misguided.
Interesting. But I guess the issue then becomes if you did stuff out your title tag, Google ends up rewriting it anyway, or does it still kind of index?
They can, and, you know, Google goes through phases where they'll rewrite or they'll take your stuff. But if you were writing, you know, the best supplements for bodybuilding as ranked by our team of, you know, publishers and editors and, you know, experts, that's going to go a little too far. But if that's a good title tag for your particular thing and it is relevant and descriptive, Google uses that relevance and descriptiveness to evaluate your page. You know, they don't truncate it just because they can only see, you know, a certain number of pixels. And that's what everybody's afraid of. But that's not, you know, that's not the thing that you should be looking at. So, you know, if I have to work on a site that has an SEO plugin, I tell the plugin to shut up while I'm writing the title tag.
That's a great piece of advice to end this podcast too. But if anyone wants to find you, follow what you're doing, anything like that, where can they do that?
Two places. One, SEO Fight Club on YouTube. We do that show every Tuesday, you know, and it covers everything under the sun. And if you're interested in finding out a little bit more about, you know, some of the SEO stuff, you can go look at my page at testedseotraining.com.
Perfect. Well, thanks for coming on and sharing some of your research there, Lee. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Until the next episode, goodbye.